Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Bob Saldick. I am chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your chair for tonight's meeting. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and on C-SPAN Book TV, which is recording this meeting, and we remind everyone that you can find us on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Charles Murray. Charles Murray was born and raised in Newton, Iowa. He graduated from Harvard University with a BA in history and from MIT with a PhD in political science. He has vast international experience, and I'll just summarize some of it. Started with the Peace Corps, worked as a contractor in Thailand for USAID. He's conducted research and studies in Ethiopia, Nigeria, Senegal, Thailand, Bulgaria, France, and, of course, the United Kingdom and the United States of America. He's best known for his 1984 seminal book about welfare reform entitled Losing Ground and for his controversial 1994 book written with Richard Herrnstein, The Bell Curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life. Dr. Murray has been a resident fellow and is now the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He lives with his wife and children near Washington, D.C. His current book is In Our Hands, A Plan to Replace the Welfare State, which he will discuss with us tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Charles Murray.
Thanks very much. It's very nice to be back at the Commonwealth Club. I've been here a couple of times before, and even when the books have been controversial, I've always found a very civil welcome here, which I'm sure will continue this evening. There is, I'm sure, in this audience a lot of differing political opinion, and it probably is not predominantly on my side of the fence, but I think we can all agree at least on one thing, which is that the current policy debate on domestic policy in Washington, D.C. Is very boring. Unless you like mud wrestling. If you're interested in ideas, what we are talking about, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, has very little to do, I think, with structural, basic reform of problems that need to be addressed. And that's what I'd like to deal with tonight. Because whether there will be eventually dramatic reform in the welfare state is not an issue. There will be. There has to be, just because of a few basic economic realities that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Presently, for example, we have Social Security, we have Medicaid and Medicare. Those are the big ticket items that alone account for 9% of gross domestic product, which is historically a huge figure. But the interesting figure is 29%, which is the percentage of GDP it is projected to consume by the year 2050. Well, it can't do that. I mean, it's impossible. Sooner or later, the politicians are going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming to reform these programs. It's going to be painful when it happens. And when it does happen, probably it will consist of the line of least resistance, which will be a few tax increases here and a few cuts in benefits there. And to me, this has hold of the wrong end of the stick. So tonight, let me take you away from all of these practical considerations and offer for you a way of doing business which is radically different, but which would work if we were to do it. It's not going to be enacted next year, but for reasons I will explain as we go along, I think something like it eventually will be enacted. It starts from the following proposition. We start with the wealthiest population in the nation, in the world. The great majority of us don't have any problem at all providing for our own retirement or living a comfortable life while we are working or taking care of our own medical insurance. So we start with that. Then we transfer about $1.5 trillion per year putatively to solve the residual problems. And we still have 36 million people below the official poverty line. We still have 40-odd million people without medical insurance. We have lots of people without comfortable retirements. So I'd like you to step back from the political gridlock we're in and just acknowledge with me, this is absurd. Only a government could spend that much money to so little effect. It is absurd that anyone does not have a decent standard of living in the United States, or let me put it more precisely, have access to it. And the solution I propose is about as simple as solutions get. Instead of taking the money to Washington and straining it through the bureaucracies and giving it back to these people who we've decided are favored and to those groups, instead of attaching exclusions to it and conditions and requirements and all the rest, why not take the money to Washington, divide it up, and give it back to the American people? Specifically, the plan I propose in the book In Our Hands goes as follows. Summarized very quickly. Every American adult, age 21 and older, who is a U.S. citizen and is not in jail, gets $10,000 a year. They do not get $10,000 a year in a paper bag on January 1st. They get monthly deposits electronically deposited into a known bank account. There are a couple of details to this plan. One of them is that $3,000 has to be allocated to health care. For reasons we can explore in more detail in the question period, and we can also explore in more detail in the question period why I think $3,000 is a figure that would provide health care, but that is one requirement. The second important thing to remember is that as of $25,000, you start to pay some of it back to the government in the form of a surtax, but not until $25,000. In other words, everything you keep when you get a low-paying job, everything you make when you get a low-paying job, you keep. Until you get to $25,000, then you have a net of $35,000, and you start to pay back. So by the time you hit $50,000, you're paying back $5,000 of it, and you are left with $5,000 residual. The question that will probably be asked is, you mean Bill Gates gets the $5,000? Yeah. Bill Gates pays into Social Security and Medicare, which are benefits that he expects to get. And whereas I can propose a plan that is not politically practical, I don't think it's appropriate to propose a plan which requires a majority of the American people to vote against their own interest. So the $5,000 is what you get in replacement for Social Security and Medicare starting at age 21 if you start making $50,000 or more at age 21. Those are the main details. Now let me start to work through why I think this is a reasonable way for us to move on two levels. First, I want to talk about the immediate effects, and then I want to turn as rapidly as I can to what I think is the much more important reason for making this change. And it has nothing to do with poverty, has nothing to do with medical care, it has to do with living satisfying lives. But first, the immediate outcomes. The simplest immediate outcome is that involuntary poverty disappears. We have had about 11% of the population, give or take a couple of percentage points, who have been below the official poverty line ever since the early 1970s. It is a number that has been incredibly resistant to change, no matter how good the economy was going or no matter who was in office. Under the plan I'm proposing, if you have, let's say, a minimum wage job, and let's say that it's economic hard times, so you are laid off for 6 months out of the year, you're going to clear about $5,000. This is pretty much a worst case for someone who's in the labor force. You add the $10,000 onto that, you've got $15,000. You're way above the official poverty line. But it actually gives you many more options than that to escape poverty. For example, suppose you're talking about a couple. Well, both of them get the $10,000. If one of them is working half-time at the minimum wage job, they now have a net of $25,000, in which we're not only talking about being technically above the poverty line, we're talking about being able to put together a decent existence quite easily. Let's suppose somebody can't work at all. You have all sorts of options because of a dynamic that I will be emphasizing throughout the presentation. It's not just that you get the $10,000. Everybody else does too, and everybody knows that everybody else gets it. Five people get together. None of them, for whatever reasons, can work. They have $50,000. Five people with $50,000 can do something with that in terms of putting together a decent lifestyle. I won't go into more detail than that. I'll simply say no one needs to live in squalor. Some people will live in squalor because of choices they make, but no one needs to live in squalor. And let me suggest to you that to get rid of involuntary poverty is a major achievement. And not only that, the people it is benefiting the most are the people who I think most of us want to benefit. We're talking about people who are trying hard to do the right thing and who, for whatever reasons, do not have the skills or whatever to become rich and famous. We are giving them the wherewithal, the possibilities for not just surviving, but for doing much better than they are now. Everybody has access to medical care. Not a trivial accomplishment. How can you do this with $3,000? Well, you'd be surprised what $3,000 will buy if you're getting into the health insurance market at age 21. Basically, you can get a health care package at age 21 for the same reason you can get a cheap life insurance policy at age 21. The insurance company makes money off you while you're young and healthy, and it can afford to pay you back when you get old and sick. I'll leave the rest of the details of that to the questions. The third thing is that everybody can put together a comfortable retirement. I do not require that anybody put money into a retirement fund. However, I do say in the book, look, if you're willing to go for the plan, if only I will require a certain amount of money to go into retirement, okay, I'll require it. And the figure I've come up with is $2,000, which is to say, if you put $2,000 into an index-based stock fund, leave it there for 45 years, and you have the worst luck of any American investor in history. If you are unlucky enough to be in a period in which you only get a 4% annual real return, which is lower than any 45-year period in American history, you will still have $250,000 by the time you retire, plus you've got the $10,000 still coming in every year. That works out to a comfortable retirement. So those are, by some standards, fairly important outcomes. They're not the most important ones. And that's what I want to turn to now. In my view, the real problem facing advanced societies in the West, Western Europe and the United States, is not how to provide comfortable retirement or health care or keep people above poverty. It is how to live a satisfying life in an age of plenty and security. In the old days, it used to be very simple. In the old days, you pretty much had to be part of a functioning community in order to survive. You pretty much had to be part of a functioning family in order to survive. Having kids was a real good idea to provide security in your old age. And you pretty much had to pay attention to spiritual issues because the possibilities of you dying anytime in the next 24 hours were real. Now, I'm talking about the exigencies that forced you to do these things, but the argument then says it turns out that human beings find deep satisfactions in being part of a functioning community. They find deep satisfactions in being a parent and spouse. And they by attending to spiritual issues, add dimensions to their lives that add weight and significance to it. We don't have to do any of those things anymore. It is perfectly possible for most of us in Western Europe and the United States to go through life with a few social friends and a few serial sex partners and spend our time quite pleasantly. And whereas I love to visit Europe, I wouldn't want to live there and grow up there and make my living there, because as far as I can tell, that has become the ethos, that the purpose of life is to while away the time as pleasantly as possible until you die. I see that in Europe's emphasis on the long vacations and the short work weeks. I see it in the plunging fertility rates, where children are no longer seen as central to a marriage and a life. I see that in the unprecedented secularism in Europe. And to me, it raises the issue of, if that's all there is, life doesn't really seem worth living. Well, I don't think that's all there is. I subscribe to the notion, and those of you in the audience who agree with me, I ask you to play along with me. I subscribe to the notion that there is such a thing as a life well lived. There is such a thing as a good life. There is such a thing as a life that is such that when we reach the age of 70 and we look back on who we have been and what we have done, we can take authentic pride and satisfaction in that. And that leads to the questions which I think are at the heart of any good social policy. What are the institutions through which people acquire these kinds of satisfactions? And I suggest to you there are only about three. One of them is vocation. And for most of the people in this room, I suspect that vocation has been a major vehicle through which you have found satisfaction in your own life. That's fine. That's been true of me as well. No objections to that. But it is also a reality that this is not a luxury that is open to everyone. Because to have vocation take on that kind of importance in your life, you have to be pretty good at something. Now, it is not something you have to have a college degree to be good at. I'm not saying that. I personally think that being a really good mechanic provides every bit as much satisfaction as being a really good lawyer. And in fact, if you look at the number of lawyers who are leaving the law at age 40 to become woodworkers or pottery makers or something, one suspects being a good mechanic may provide more satisfaction than being a good lawyer for many people. So I'm not saying that it's limited to people with high educations or high IQs or anything else. I am saying you have to be good at something. And not everybody is good at something. After the bell curve came out, I occasionally tested audiences to see if I would get booed by observing that half the population was below average in IQ. And sometimes I would, as a matter of fact. And it's not just that. 50% of the population is below average in industriousness, is below average in beauty, is below average in charm, is below average in any quality that goes into success in life. And a lot of people are below average in all of those. That has no relationship to their dignity as human beings. But it does have this one important effect, that the sources of satisfaction open to them are much more focused in two other institutions, and that those are family and community. To a lot of us in this room, geographic community isn't very important. Our communities consist of professional associations and social associations that may stretch across the world. For a lot of people, geographic community is real important. For a lot of us, maybe family isn't that important. I think probably here there is a relationship with age. As I look in the audience and see people of my generation, I think a lot of us who are completely absorbed in our vocations as youths are taking more satisfaction in family now. But nonetheless, family is centrally important to a lot of people who do not have vocation as a source of satisfaction. How does this relate to the plan? Because what I'm really doing by replacing the welfare state with the $10,000 a year is not just giving people money. I'm also taking all the responsibilities that have been abrogated by the welfare state, and I am giving them back to families and communities. That's the reason for the title of the book, In Our Hands. It once again takes the stuff of life and puts it back in our hands, defined as ours as individuals, ours as families, and ours as communities. Now, one of the reactions I get many times is, we don't want that. We want these things to be taken care of by official government organizations. We don't all need to be social workers in our spare time. We can't rely on private institutions to fill in all the gaps and all that. And part of, I guess, the argument I would like to make to you is, no, it doesn't work that way. The welfare state does say we will take care of that regarding a lot of complex human needs. The welfare state does not do that. The welfare state has historically, and now I'm talking about empirical issues with which I'd be happy to go to the mat with any of you about what the literature says, the welfare state has been extraordinarily ineffectual in dealing with complex human needs. And there is a reason for that. It is not that bureaucrats are lazy. It is not that they are unmotivated. It is that the bureaucratic interests of any governmental entity inescapably, inherently, ultimately have to do with expanding the size and the influence of that organization. That's just the way institutionally these things work. And there's one other problem, which is that any government entity is not required to elicit the voluntary cooperation of the people it is interacting with. It can set out rules that they have to obey. The Salvation Army, even though the Salvation Army is pretty good at putting expectations on the people it helps, has to elicit their voluntary cooperation. It has to be run in a way which responds to needs that brings them back again. And the same goes with any institution which has a reliance on donors, that has a reliance on volunteers. In all of these cases, the interactions that go on are inherently much more adept at dealing with complex human needs because it doesn't have any choice but try to get at the heart of what's going on. And governmental bureaucrats simply have been very bad at that. But it's not that I want us all to be part-time social workers. It is rather that what would happen if we returned these functions to localities is an enrichment of life that would affect not just a certain segment of people that we say are the poor or the disadvantaged. It would enrich the lives of all of us. I think Aristotle was right. I think that virtue has the characteristics of a practice and of a habit. It's not good enough to tell our children you ought to be virtuous. They have to practice virtuous acts. And they have to practice it in the same way that they practice the piano. They also have to live in a world where being a good person does not consist of being part of an advocacy group that wants to have some good thing done in some distant bureaucracy. It consists of living in communities in which we are dealing with human needs around us, and we see other people dealing with human needs around us all the time. You need to re-inject in everyday life, not just for the poor, but for all of us, what I've referred to as the stuff of life. Now, it may have crossed your mind that none of this has a snowball's chance in hell of being passed in any form as I'm proposing it. Let me suggest to you that as time goes on, something very like this almost inevitably has to come to pass for a couple of reasons. The first is that the nation just keeps getting richer and richer. If you plot real GDP, real gross domestic product, on a graph, which I have in the book, from 1900 up to the present time, it forms a remarkably even, consistent line that is a curve that fits a mathematical equation for nonlinear growth. And even though we think that the current president or a past president or somebody else was the best thing or the worst thing to happen to the economy in years, it turns out it doesn't make all that much difference. In the Depression, you get a few dots below the line, and in a few other administrations, you get a few dots a little bit above the line, but generally the country keeps getting richer. As long as our leaders do not prove to be as incompetent as the Soviet leaders were, we can expect the country to continue getting richer. And this cannot go on for much longer without it becoming obvious that lack of money is not the reason we still have poor people, that we still have people without health care, that we still have people without comfortable retirements. The budgets we will be spending within a very short period of time will be such that it's quite obvious that we are not spending too little, we are spending it badly. That's the first thing that's going to happen. The second thing that I have confidence is going to happen as time goes on is that the incompetence of government will become more obvious to all of us. And by that, I don't mean anything very exotic. I simply mean that in our own lives, we know that almost any time we deal with government, it's not done as well as it is done when we deal with other private institutions. You know that when you go to a government cafeteria, it's probably not going to be as good as any fast food store across the street from it. You know when you go into a government facility, it probably isn't going to be kept up as well as any private institution. These are little things. But they add up. I had a friend once who came back from the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, another libertarian like me, and I asked him what it was like. And he said, he didn't feel afraid. He didn't feel like it was a tyranny. He said, it's as if the entire nation were run by the Virginia Department of Motor Vehicles. And that is, I think, the thing that is going to become obvious to us as time goes on. And it is true as well of our attempts to deal with complex human needs. So the combination of knowing we have the money, but we're spending it badly, and an increasing realization that government is out of its depth when it tries to deal with many kinds of human needs, are going to lead to something similar to this. We can afford it. The plan I have proposed will cost no more than the current system as of 2011. It will cost $500 billion less than the current plan as of 2020. It will cost $1 trillion per year less by 2028. So we can afford it financially, and we can use some of those savings to finance what will be very large transition costs. The question is, can we afford it emotionally and psychologically? There is a great deal of comfort in thinking that we are trying hard, even if we aren't achieving what we want to achieve. And a lot of us have taken satisfaction in saying, well, you know, I pay a lot of taxes for these problems to be dealt with. And if the problems are not being dealt with, we can still say, well, at least I'm doing my part. And in one sense, what I am asking is a more demanding standard, that we leave behind the security of saying, well, we passed a law that says there isn't supposed to be any of these problems, and instead go to an older American tradition, which says that it is up to us as spouses and as friends and as neighbors, to meet the human needs around us, to celebrate success, to commiserate with failure, to succor the sick and those who need comforting, for that matter, to scorn the bad as well as to celebrate the good. We will do that when enough people begin to feel that life has been denuded of too much of what makes it worth living. And at that point, at some time in the future, this seemingly impossible plan that I have outlined to you will become a reality. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Charles Murray, Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of In Our Hands, A Plan to Replace the Welfare State, for his comments today. Dr. Murray, we've got a lot of questions, so I'm going to plunge right in. I'm going to combine a few questions, which I think reflect something that's bothering many people in our audience. Your plan sounds great, but how do you educate those who don't know how to deal with money? People will squander the $10,000 unrelated. What about the con artists who come in and scoop up the money from the Skid Row folks? And in your plan, how do we take care of innocent children of the profligate? And it goes on and on.
I didn't spend much time in that in the speech because I had a feeling I was going to get those questions. And so let me give you short answers and long answers. One short answer. Most of the people who are profligate and waste their money and don't handle things right now are not saved by any safety nets currently in existence. It is not the case that if you behave that way, that you are typically on welfare or receiving any other kind of assistance. So what I'm doing is not saying I'm going to rip away supports that currently help those folks. For most of those folks, those supports don't exist. A slightly longer answer goes as follows. You have wasted this month's check. How many of us have not wasted the first paycheck we got or wasted some other windfall? Well, you're getting another check or you're getting another deposit next month. But the more interesting level of thinking about this is not people in isolation saying, well, gee, maybe I ought to change my ways. The real key to thinking about this is that everybody knows you have that income stream. So you've wasted your money, you don't have any help, you have to go to somebody. Maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a relative, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's a Salvation Army, I don't know. But the dialogue that is set up goes like this. Okay, we won't let you starve in the streets. let's talk about different choices you can start to make next month. That's not going to be a one-time dialogue. That is going to be an ongoing feedback loop. And you cannot think about the processes that are set in motion unless you think of it that way. Now, does this mean everybody is going to straighten up? No, it doesn't. But I guess I would ask those of you who raise this question, and it's a legitimate question, to ask yourselves, how many people do you think are incapable of learning from mistakes? Are there any? Yes. Do they constitute a lot of people? I'm more optimistic than a lot of others in this regard. I don't think that the people that we call the poor or the disadvantaged, they aren't subhuman, they aren't mindless, they're just like us in terms of dealing with life as it occurs around them, and suddenly they have a couple of things that many of them have not had before. One of them is the money, with a new deposit every month. The other is the responsibility. And the ways that that will play out are very hard to predict in advance, but I can give you a few simple examples. One of them I call the Doolittle effect. I call it the Doolittle effect after Alfred Doolittle in My Fair Lady. I find with audiences, some people say, yeah, I know what he's talking about, and others say, what? In My Fair Lady, Alfred Doolittle is a member in good standing of the underclass. He neglected to marry Eliza's mother. He works as little as possible. But then Henry Higgins recommends him as the most original moralist in England, and he receives a large bequest from an American philanthropist. There, whereupon, he is, in his own words, caught in middle-class morality. And that's why he has to get to the church on time. If you remember the famous song, he has to go marry Eliza's mother, or at least his current girlfriend. I'm not sure if he's Eliza's mother, she's Eliza's mother or not. Well, responsibility, in effect, is given to people whether they want it or not. And I will translate the Doolittle effect into something that's very common in low-income neighborhoods, which is you have a young man who's living off his girlfriend. Right now, he can say to her, hey, there aren't any jobs out there, or the jobs that I can get are too demeaning, and so there's nothing I can do. All at once, there is something he can do. All at once, honey, you can fork over part of your monthly check to help pay for the groceries and the rent. And that kind of pressure is going to be available because the money is coming into a known bank account. Let me put a more brutal way in which incentives will change radically. Right now, if you're a low-income male and you impregnate your girlfriend and she has the baby, all the child support laws in the world don't do much good because you can disappear and can't be found, or you just don't have a job. All at once, you have a known income stream coming into a known bank account that any judge can tap. Think that'll have any effect at all on little boys looking at their older brothers who are forking over large amounts of money to support children? I think it will. Similarly, as far as that's concerned, the young woman who right now only gets benefits if she has a baby now is going to be looking at older sisters, some of whom have had babies and are spending their money on diapers and on baby food, and others of whom are spending it on an apartment and education and clothes or whatever they want to be spending it on. That, too, will have a major effect on incentives. So I'm giving a long answer to an important question. And what I'm really saying is that for the vast majority of the population, we do exactly what we need to do. We set in motion powerful social signals, sometimes in the form of encouragement, sometimes in the form of pressure, sometimes in the form of stigma, but they're all ongoing and they are all done not by people who are applying bureaucratic rules, but by responding to us as individual human beings. One last word on this question, which has to do with the clinically mentally ill, or for that matter with children who are the victims of genuine neglect or abuse. In those cases, I consider that the system is unchanged. They right now are adjudicated by the courts as being mentally incompetent, or they are adjudicated as being, parents are adjudicated as being guilty of a felony. And you have to provide services as part of the government's response to that in the same way that if you convict people and send them to jail, you have to build prisons. So that part of it remains unchanged. But that's a very small part of the total human needs that I'm talking about.
We have several questions about other plans, and let me summarize. One first one is, isn't your plan nearly identical to the so-called negative income tax that was proposed 20 or 30 years ago? Another question about plans in other countries, especially Sweden. People get a payment from the government. Does that work there or in other countries? Another question about Asia, where there's very few social programs, but for people who are dependent on families.
Mm-hmm.
How does this proposal of yours?
Let's start out with giving credit where credit is due. Milton Friedman first had the idea for a negative income tax back in the 1940s, which would top up people's income, and that became popular in the 60s and was even tried as an experiment in the 1970s. This is it borrows from that. In fact, the lead page of the book describes Milton Friedman's contribution in this regard, but it's importantly different in a couple of ways. One is that it replaces everything as opposed to augments it, and that is absolutely crucial. If you give the kind of cash grant I'm talking about on top of the existing body of services, it would be a disaster for a lot of the reasons. All of the things I just said about the social signals that would be set in motion would no longer be true. You can't do it that way. A second problem with the negative income tax that was fatal is that as soon as you started to work, you started to lose it. So if you took a low-paying job, let's say you made, let's say the grant were $10,000, and you started taking it away as soon as a person made money, well, if you got a $12,000 a year job, you'd in effect be working for $2,000 a year, and nobody would do that. That's the reason why I set that payback point so high, up at $25,000. In effect, what I do is I lure people into working until they can't afford to quit. They're making 35 net by the time they start to pay any tax at all, and at that point, very few people are going to quit and work for live on 10. In terms of Sweden with its elaborate social welfare state, it's like all welfare states, which is it stage manages people's lives. And it for many years, it did so quite successfully as long as the only people it had to deal with were Swedes. So you could have work requirements, which were pretty well observed, but you had lots of rules and regulations. So you got certain payments, but boy, did you have to toe the mark in order to qualify for them. I'm sort of equally against governmental attempts to stage manage lives, whether they come from the left or from the right. And my objection to life in Sweden is the objection I voiced earlier, that you ship too much of the stuff of life downtown to the bureaucracies when you try to function that way. Asia, I lived for 6 years in Thailand, working in rural villages most of the time, and it's the reason I became a libertarian. I started out my career in Thailand working as a Peace Corps volunteer where I was constantly focused on the programs that Bangkok was shipping out to the villages and getting frustrated, as did my Thai colleagues, because these villagers seemed so resistant to doing these obviously useful things that we were trying to do for them. Then after I got out of Peace Corps, I would go to those same kinds of villages, but I would be talking to villagers and hearing it from their point of view. And guess what? All of these things that Bangkok wanted them to do were not things they wanted to do, and in fact usually messed up things more than they helped. Also, when I looked at Thai villages when the government wasn't around, all at once I realized they were really pretty good at solving their own problems, and that when the Thai government came in and tried to be helpful, more often than not, it took a functioning village and made it dysfunctional. So it was a pivotal experience in terms of turning me into a political radical.
Would you comment on the expected impact of your program on marriage for young people and not so young people? Will this make it better or worse or what?
Very interesting question. It's a very interesting question. You have several ways of thinking about it. One is, what will it do about the decision to marry in the first place? And that could play out a bunch of different ways. It all depends, I think, on whether you're living in a society in which marriage confers benefits, particularly on the father of a child, that cohabiting does not. So that if you live in a regime in which if you are the father of a child and if you are not married, you have no legal rights regarding that child, then I think you get one set of ways in which the incentives to marry change, and they actually increase. Because just as the father has no legal rights, also he has no obligations, so the wife can't enforce obligations on him, or the mother can't. So a lot of that pushes toward increased marriage. But Increasingly, the legal regime in the United States is that marriage doesn't make any difference with regard to that, that you have pretty much the same rights and obligations regarding children, whether you're married or not married. In that case, I think it's pretty much a wash. It makes it easier to get married for those who wanted to get married but were restrained because they felt they didn't have enough money. I think the real change in married life comes from the fact that the woman in a marriage gets the $10,000 no matter what her husband makes. And that's going to have a couple of very important effects. Think of, for example, of couples in which the woman is in the workforce, but only because she has to. She would rather be home as a full-time mother and housewife. She can't afford to do it. In that case, there's a wide range of incomes at which the $10,000 makes the difference between not being able to afford to do that and being able to afford to do that. Conversely, if you have women who want to be in the workforce but right now have to pay a lot in child care and it's very difficult to do it, it makes it easier for them to make the investment to get into the labor force. In both of those cases, I think it's a positive outcome. In both of those cases, you are providing greater choice for women to do what they want to do, and I think marriages tend to be happier when one partner in that marriage is not constrained by circumstances to live a life that, in the case of the wife, she does not want to live. So I think that what this would do with regard to marriage is restore restore a lot of depth to a lot of marriages, because I think there would be a fairly large response of women who want to stay home with children. And I think in those cases you probably have some very positive long-term social consequences as well. The other thing it does with marriage is that it restores part of the traditional narrative. It used to be that when you got married, first place, you didn't get married until the husband would have a sufficient income. That seems like a very old-fashioned notion, but it was true up until about 50 or 60 years ago. So you delayed marriage until you were going to be economically able to afford it. And then when you did it, you were joining together, pooling your assets and your resources and your efforts to make a life together. Well, in many very low-income communities, one of the very common things you hear, especially from women, is why get married? The guy is just going to be more of a burden than he is a help. If the guy is unemployed and so forth. When you have two people each bringing assets to the marriage in the form of the grant, there is a necessary pooling of resources that you don't have any choice in. There are resources coming in from both sides, and in many ways looking at the person you marry as someone who is bringing assets to that marriage, I think restores what I call the narrative, the traditional narrative of marriage, which is also likely to be strengthening.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Charles Murray, social critic and scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who is discussing his plan to eliminate Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare.
And corporate welfare and agricultural subsidies.
We're going to
It's a clean sweep. Clean sweep of everything.
We hope to get to that. The question here about income inequality. Do you consider the income inequality that exists in this country today a problem, and how will your plan impact it one way or the other?
In a way, this book could be considered the policy afterword to the bell curve. The bell curve's thesis was that in the 20th century we saw a revolution in which the value of brains rose dramatically and the value of a strong back fell. And this produced a situation which threatens to create a new kind of class society. No, I will take away the word threatens. We said threatens in 1994 when we wrote the book. I think that the subsequent 12 years have vindicated that, in fact, such a class society is well along its way to formation. There is nothing that people deserve less than their IQ. Nobody earns his IQ. And the same goes with many of the other attributes that are rewarded these days financially. So here you have a libertarian, who is me, saying that I want to have a more massive redistribution of money from the haves to the have-nots than Teddy Kennedy has dreamed of in his wildest fantasies. And some of my libertarian friends are not real happy about this, but here's the way I look at it. We are so rich now that whatever the philosophical preferences I would have if I could wave a magic wand, we can afford to augment the income of people who have gotten the short end of the stick through no fault of their own. And in doing so, we are enhancing the lives of tens of millions, if not more than 100 million, of our fellow citizens, enabling them qualitatively to live a better life than they were able to live before. This is not the same as saying I'm upset about income inequality per se. I think inequality in its largest sense is enriching and makes life more interesting and the rest of it. But the kind of inequality whereby even though you are trying your damnedest, you still can barely hold your life together, that kind bothers me. And that's the kind of inequality that this plan tries to address, that it does address, period.
We do have several questions, including a newly arriving one about the cost of your program. So people are puzzled on where the money's going to come from for all this.
This is the most amazing part, because one of the initial reactions I always get is, we can't afford this. Yeah, we can. You can project the costs of this quite accurately with a few basic facts about the demographics and the income distribution. And a statement I think I made during the speech is absolutely accurate. Given the Congressional Budget Office's projection of the costs of the current system, and I've used the lower end of their projections of the rises in costs there, what I am proposing would cost no more than the current system as of 2011, and we can be quite confident that this is not going to pass before 2011. So that's very soon. That's how much money we are spending. It requires emphasis. I do not, in the book, go into the question of how many government jobs will be lost, because I'm not preaching to the choir. I'm not preaching to those who want to see small government because there are just way too many bureaucrats there. But I did do some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and I think you're looking at about 200,000 to 300,000 federal employees who lose their jobs, liberated for productive work. I'm sorry to any federal employees in the audience. The reason I mentioned that number is this. Contemplate that number and think what the implications are for that of how much of the money never gets back out to do what it was intended to do. When I say that the government is spending the money badly and ineffectually, I mean that quite literally. There is plenty of money so that no one in this country needs to be poor. That money is there. It's a matter of how we choose to spend it.
Your plan does not address cultural attitudes among some low-income people, for example, calling the ambulance or going to the ER for minor ailments. Do you agree that other mechanisms must go along with this, for example, non-emergency clinics?
Well, we're talking about a world which is – we're not talking about the transition period, by the way. Just let's all keep that in mind. We're talking about a world in which everybody is in the system at age 21 and so forth, and they also have health insurance when they're in the system. Now, a couple of things happen at this point. One is that not only do all the friends and neighbors know that everybody has the money, so do all the hospitals and so forth know that people have the money. And there will be, I think, in large part, a much of – it's not going to be as easy to go to the OR. There are going to be pressures not to do that and use that as a free resource. Having said that, I have a feeling that among the various kinds of things which will arise as a result of this, new kinds of medical care will be at the very forefront of it. I didn't get into this during the body of the speech, but historically what happened after the New Deal is that the whole direction of mutual assistance and philanthropy shifted. We had into the 1920s and 1930s an incredibly vast network of voluntary associations doing all kinds of things. You had organizations we now think of as purely social clubs, like the Elks, which had millions of members and were also having mutual insurance plans that they administered, and very large philanthropic activities. Once the New Deal came into place, you had a displacement effect. And so donors to philanthropy said, well, I'm not going to be giving money to the things the government's doing. I'm going to give it to the symphony instead. You can expect, when the plan goes into effect, that there is going to be a great shift, again, in philanthropic activity into areas in which the government is no longer picking up the slack, which I think is a good thing. But if I choose those which are the things which will get the most money the quickest, it's going to be medical care for people who still need it, and it's going to be especially medical care for children. That would be my expectation.
What do you think of the fact that the governor of Massachusetts just signed a bill into law to provide universal health care for all the state's citizens? Is this a step in the right direction? Is this going to spread to other states?
Well, it's one of the great things about federalism, isn't it, that Massachusetts can try this first, because it's one of those where, whatever our predictions are, I have a feeling we don't know how it's going to actually play out in practice. I'm sympathetic to the idea of requiring the health insurance just because I think of car insurance as something which has worked pretty well. You can't drive a car in this country unless you're insured, and somehow people manage to come up with the money to provide for the insurance for themselves, and somehow the insurance companies come up with ways to distribute the risk so that they divvy up the bad risks among them and make it work. And so the optimistic view of it is that Massachusetts, by doing this, which sounds like too simple a solution, just require people to buy health insurance, they may be onto something. But let's let Massachusetts do it first before we do it all around the rest of the country and see what happens.
Can you suggest a way to validate your plan experimentally?
Well, I used to say that when I was talking about getting rid of all income supports for single women with children, which is another one of the topics with which I've been associated in the past, that I wanted this to be tried first in Utah and North Dakota, thinking, you know, let's start where the problems are small. The difficulty with this is that it can't be temporary and it can't be an experiment. If it's an experiment and if people know it can go away, all of these important changes in the way we do business just won't happen. I think instead the process, as I try to think ahead and say, how can this idea eventually become law or something like it, I think it's going to be a very long period of a changing conventional wisdom. And I go back to the experience I had after Losing Ground. I published Losing Ground in 1984, at which time I was talking about getting rid of the welfare system. And at the time I wrote that last chapter, I wrote it explicitly as a thought experiment, saying, look, I don't have any practical solutions, and so therefore I'm going to give you this wild-eyed thought experiment. Pretty much the same thing I've done with this book. I'm pretty much a Johnny OneNote in this regard. And at that time, everybody treated it as a wild-eyed thing because there was no political will to do anything remotely like that. Well, 12 years later, we had the Welfare Reform Act of 1996. I am not saying that was a perfect implementation of what I had in mind by any means, but I will say it was radically different from anything that was politically possible in 1984. Well, the same thing I think will happen here. You're talking about both liberals and conservatives who, as time goes on, are going to be saying, this is silly. The way we're doing business is silly. There's a better way to do it. Just give the money to the people. And it, insofar as it starts to cut across party lines, the same way that welfare reform cut across party lines, the politicians may eventually come around. But it's going to be an evolutionary process. There will be no road to Damascus in this one.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Charles Murray, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who is discussing his plan to eliminate Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare. Here's a question about Europe. Your simple-minded stereotype of Europe ignores their excellent industry, scholarship, and culture in order to dismiss the success of their social welfare system. Why not admit that it does work?
I wrote a book called Human Accomplishment that was published a few years ago, in which I just fell in love with European achievement. And at the same time, I became increasingly sadder about what is happening to Europe now. I'm reminded of when I gave a speech in Stockholm and was telling them how I'm always asked about Sweden, or I used to be always asked about Sweden as a great success story, and that my answer in that case was that almost any system will work for a while as long as you're governing Swedes. And it got a laugh from a Swedish audience, which is not an easy thing to do, but there was a lot of truth to that. There was a lot of truth to that. And what Sweden is discovering now, what Germany is discovering, what Denmark and the Netherlands is discovering, is that a great deal of the success of their system had nothing to do with the system. It had everything to do with a social consensus and an ethos that had been centuries in the making. They have been spending down their cultural capital. And what you see throughout Western Europe are developing underclasses, whereby life in the capitals of Europe has changed remarkably. You are seeing social stresses and strains, which 15, 20 years ago they said are impossible to have in these kinds of countries. You are also seeing a forthcoming financial crisis. If you don't have babies, you can't pay for these very elaborate welfare states. You have a choice. Either you have to jettison the system, or you have to have so many young immigrants that you can afford to pay for it, but as you bring in the young immigrants, the system collapses. I will say in response directly to the question, for several decades, Europe thought that they were the way of the future. And as of 1980s, when I was going to Europe and talking about this, I had to work very energetically to make the case that this couldn't last. As I go back to Europe now, and as I talk to people in Europe and give lectures like this one and so forth, I'm no longer finding the audiences saying, "This crazy American." I'm finding audiences nodding their heads. So, no, I will admit a glorious past for Europe, and I will argue that what is happening now is tragic, poignant, and that Europe as we know it will not survive into the 22nd century.
Are there truly no programs that a civilized society should continue? Do you really believe that private enterprise and, as you say, community will fill any gaps in your plan?
It's the hardest case to make without personal experience. When I say that government is inherently, inescapably incapable of dealing with complex human needs, I mean exactly what I'm saying. There are no exceptions. You can do things like deliver medical services. Yes, you can do that, and you can do that through government, or you can do it through private means. You do it more efficiently through private. But as soon as you get into the kinds of problems that require changing people's behaviors, go talk to any physician who works in one of those emergency rooms in an inner-city hospital. As soon as you get off of the case of stitching up whatever needs stitching up and get into a situation where you're trying to change behavior, all at once, compulsion doesn't work. The only thing that is going to work is being embedded in a nexus of people who care. And the only way you get to that kind of state is through, it's not a choice. You only do it through private institutions. This is the hardest point of contention I have with audiences on the left when I'm on the right, because there is a continued belief that government, if constructed properly, if you get the right rules in place, if you get the incentives right for the occupants of the positions, you can make it work. And what I'm saying now, not as a right-wing ideologue, but as a social scientist, is that there's a lot of data on this. There's a lot of literature on this. I spent the 70s as an evaluator of social programs. I am saying it is not a case of, gee, only 20% of the programs worked, whereas 80% of the programs failed to deal with these kinds of human needs. The iron law of program evaluation in the 1970s, as was stated by one famous scholar, was that the expected net impact of a social program is zero. And that was the experience which, along with my years in Thai villages, tended to radicalize me as well.
What is the downside to this plan?
Well, I'm asked sometimes, is there anything in the book that you say to yourself, nah, you couldn't really do that? I have great confidence in all the dynamics I've described to you. The real problem is this, that even if we were to enact it, that there would immediately be an impulse to start to build a mini food stamp program and a mini Medicaid program. And so therefore, at the beginning of the book, I say this must be accompanied by a constitutional amendment written in language that even Supreme Court justices cannot misinterpret, saying thou shalt have no transfer payments before thee except this one. So you may not have any resuscitation of any transfer programs except the grant. And I say to myself, is it possible to write a constitutional amendment that the Supreme Court cannot misinterpret? And there I have to say to myself, I'm not sure. So that one is tough. But what I'm really doing is this. We are now talking about a different way of approaching problems. And the place to talk about it is not the politicians, because they're going to be hopeless for the foreseeable future. It has to be to audiences like this. And what you take away from this, I hope, is not a blueprint that you're confident can be done. That's not what I'm trying to persuade you of. What I'm trying to persuade you of is that this, it conceptually, is something that would work. And not just work in mechanistic ways, putting more money into people's pockets. Work in ways that you would find attractive in ways that changes your own life. I've been a great fan of thought experiments for a long time. In Losing Ground, I have one which said, suppose you knew that you and your wife were going to be run over tomorrow by a bus, and you had a small child. Would you rather have that child placed in a family that had plenty of material goods, but in which nobody ever worked and nobody cared about teaching your child values and so forth? Or would you rather put your child with a very poor family, where your child would actually go hungry sometimes and have ragged clothes, but a family that was loving and would inculcate in it the kinds of values you want? And the answer is obvious. We all choose the second family. Well, I guess I would have another thought experiment. And this is not a thought experiment for your children. This is a thought experiment for where you would like to live. Suppose you had the short end of the stick in a variety of characteristics, which meant you were never going to be rich and famous, you were never going to be a successful lawyer or physician or anything else, but you wanted to live a satisfying life. Is the world I describe one in which you would find it easier or harder to create a satisfying life for yourself? And in that answer, I hope that at least some of you will find it worthwhile to think about this possibility after you leave.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program that's time for only one last question, and several people have posed it one way or another, and so let me summarize by asking whether your next book will be about corporate welfare.
I just got done saying I get rid of corporate welfare lock, stock, and barrel. Every single solitary bit of it goes, and agricultural subsidies and the rest of it. I am also not a fan of welfare, whether it is corporate or for poor people. The next book has the working title, Decadence. The subtitle I'm considering is a sympathetic perspective, because there are some aspects of decadence I find quite enjoyable, but it is going to be a book which continues some themes about broader social trends that I'm just beginning to explore.
Our thanks to Dr. Charles Murray Brady, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of In Our Hands, A Plan to Replace the Welfare State, for his comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio and in the television audience. My name is Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.